Hello, everybody. I'm Cody.
And I'm Brent.
And we are the Hugonauts, here to review and discuss with you the best sci-fi novels of all time. This week, we have an author interview with Becky Chambers, which we're really excited about. And don't forget to like, subscribe, download, follow, however you listen to us, to not miss the next episode, which will be on the book Providence by Max Barry with our special guest, Lori, from Hugo Girl, the podcast, which will be a very fun episode as well. But for now, Brent, you want to give us a little primer on Becky Chambers?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so excited about this. So Becky Chambers is the best-selling author of the Wayfarers series, including The Galaxy and the Ground Within was the last book a couple of years ago, and then the first one, Long Way to a Small Angry Planet. She's also the author of the Monk and Robot novellas and other standalone works of science fiction. She's a two-time Hugo Award winner and has been nominated for the Nebula, the Locus, the Arthur C. Clarke Award, and the Women's Prize for Fiction, among others. Her latest book is A Prayer for the Crown Shy, the second installment in the Monk and Robot series. She is currently writing a new novel in a new universe. So with that, let's welcome Becky.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Okay, well, we have a lot to ask you, but first, we'd, I guess, love to sort of start at the beginning. Even more than most people in the genre, you sort of like come from a science and like sci-fi family. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm the weird artsy one in my family. Everybody else is in STEM. My mom is an astrobiology educator. Actually, as we speak right now, she's doing a 2-week program on a research vessel that's in port in Barcelona that they drill cores from the ocean floor. So I've been getting text messages of tiny microscopic plankton and stuff the last few days.
That's fabulous. So cool.
That's awesome.
It's super cool. then my dad, he's retired now, but he was an aerospace engineer. He worked in satellites. And my grandfather, my mom's dad, he was an old school rocket scientist. He was a mathematician and was contracted to work on orbital mechanics during the Apollo program and on the shuttle then later as well. So for me, I took it very much for granted as a kid that space was just something everybody's family does. Like, it didn't occur to me that it was at all unusual. This is just what people do and what people care about. And so even though I went in an artsier direction, obviously I am still expressing that in my own way. I didn't formally study STEM. I was a theater major, which actually still serves me well. So it's something that has always been a big part of my life, but I was very much encouraged by my parents to follow my own path. And so in a lot of ways, even though I couldn't help but absorb a love for science, a love for STEM growing up in that environment, I do feel in a lot of ways that I kind of came to it on my own. It was something that I was allowed to choose.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I was going to ask, did you have so much of growing up is that trying to find one's own path and like define yourself. Did you have some time where you were like, well, I'm, you know, going to get as far away from all of this as possible? Was that part of your experience?
Not so much, but I think for me, art and science have always been two loves that go hand in hand. And I really see them as a lot more complementary than I think they are commonly portrayed as. You know, in a way, they're both a search for the truth. And they're very different ways of getting there, obviously. But they're both an expression of love for the real world. I firmly believe that about science fiction. We're never actually writing about, we're never trying to predict the future. We're never trying to be prescriptive about what the world should be like. We're writing about the here and now. And for me, at least, making things up is a means of connecting more strongly to reality. And so in that, I see my love for science, my love for the natural world, and my love for completely impossible things really just two halves of the same thing. And that has been true of me for as long as I can remember. So I know there was never a point at which I really seriously considered going into STEM as a career. When I was 12, I said I wanted to be an astronomer, but really what I wanted to be was Jodie Foster in the movie Contact. It took me a few years to realize, you know what, I'm decent at math, but I don't want to do that much math in my life. But yeah, there was never a point at which I was like, I want to get away from this. It's both of those things have been constant companions for me ever since I was little.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, cool. Well, let's talk about how you sort of like got into the world of writing and broke into the world of writing. Getting traditional publishing is very hard. You sort of found your own way. You made it happen. So for the listeners, so you self-published your first book, and then a couple of years later, it got published, and then lots of awards and history, and anyway, it's all gone very well. But I would love to sort of hear about how that felt. Presumably you tried to go the traditional publishing route, and maybe that didn't go. But anyway, yeah, take us through it and how it felt for you to sort of work through all that.
Absolutely. So I've been writing ever since I was young, but it was really in my mid-20s or so that I started pursuing it as a career. I did start out working in theater, and it became obvious to me very quickly that the stories I was interested in were happening elsewhere, you know, and I would go to work at the theater during the day, and I noticed that my friends and colleagues would go to one act festivals and go see other shows at night. I would go home and watch Star Trek and play video games and read sci-fi books, you know, and there was a point at which I just was like, you know what, I think I need to pay attention to that. I need to go chase that. And so I started really working seriously on fiction, but obviously I had to pay the bills. And so I was doing a lot of freelance writing at the time, largely technical writing, you know, translating engineer into normal human speak was my bread and butter for a while. And when I eventually started working on The Long Way to a Small Angry Planet, working on it in full because it was, you know, bits and pieces that I'd had in my brain for years, but when I finally sat down to put it all together, I reached this point at which there was a gap in my paying gigs. I had 2 months that I had nothing lined up. And this is at a point in my life where it was very much paycheck to paycheck. You know, it was, there was no real cushion there. So, but I'm stubborn and a little dumb when I... I decide that I'm going to do something. And I was like, I'm so close to finishing this book. So I went to Kickstarter and I started a Kickstarter campaign and said, I need 2 months to finish a book. And I was very upfront about it in the campaign in that I knew from the jump that traditional publishing would be a better fit for me. Not because I don't think there's any more validity to traditional publishing than there is to self-publishing. They're both excellent means of getting a story out there. Any way you can get your story out there is great. But I am not a marketing person. I'm not a publicist. And I have a difficult time sort of pitching myself in that respect. I'm not really into social media. I'm not really into, you know, that all the things you have to be able to do if you're going to really successfully self-publish. So I said in my initial campaign that I needed to finish this book and, I wanted to finish this book. I was hopeful that I would finish this book. I needed those 2 months to get it done and that I was planning to pursue traditional publishing after that. And to my eternal surprise, the campaign was a success. And so I finished the book and I did get an agent and went out on submission and all of those things. And my first time out the gate, it wasn't successful. The book didn't get picked up. My agent got a different job. And so I was in this position where it was like, okay, I can either start from scratch and go out there and keep querying and keep, you know, trying to get my foot in the door. But I have these backers, most of whom are strangers, who gave me what I needed to tell this story. And I feel like I owe it to them to put this book in their hands. So that's when I decided to self-publish, mostly out of, I wouldn't say obligation, but sort of like, you know, fulfilling my end of the deal. Here's the story you helped make. And I basically, you know, I sold enough copies to make back the amount I had spent on cover art. It did not go very far. And from there, it was purely dumb luck. I went to my first Worldcon in London in 2014. Or it might have been 2013, doesn't matter. But I went to Worldcon in London and I was at a party and I met this woman. We hit it off. We were just chatting. Again, being amazing at self-promotion, I did not mention that I had a book out. We were just talking. And a few months later, I got this email from her out of the blue saying, hey, I read your book and I'm an editor at, you know, a publishing house. Would you like a contract? And I was like, yes, I would very much like that. So, it was a completely random situation that that changed my entire life. So I'm very happy to be within the traditional publishing world, but obviously my path there was not as traditional as is typical. So
for sure. Well, none of that would have worked if you hadn't written something great and put it out there. So yeah.
And perhaps the fact that you didn't self-promote with the editor helped you.
Maybe you just met them
as a person. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, very cool. All right. So in all of your books, the characters are amazing. It's like the heart and soul of your writing. And would love to hear, you know, sort of your process for coming up with a character.
With all aspects of, writing a book, I like to compare it to making dinner out of whatever leftovers you have in the fridge. Like, it's all just bits and pieces of things I collect as I go through life. So when I'm creating a new character, often I am drawing from real people. Not typically like copy pasting a whole person that I know in real life into the book. I've done that on occasion, but often I am thinking of conversations I've had, conversations I've overheard. I do like to eavesdrop, I will admit. Interactions with other humans is often where I start with that. A character will start with a niche they need to fill, an idea I'm trying to communicate, a culture I'm trying to illustrate through an individual that's a product of it. And so with each and every one of them, it's this very, very individual, very intimate process where I can't really say, you know, there's like a one size fits all blueprint for how I'm going to figure this person out. Every character has different needs, just as every story has different needs. And so it's just a matter of spending time with them until I figure out their voice, their deal, where it is that they come from. I will say that, drawing from my theater background, often what I do when I'm starting a book is I write what a friend of mine has refers to as prose script, where I will, I just write dialogue first. And it looks a lot like the script for a play, where I will write just lines with sort of stage directions, quote unquote, in between. You know, here's where you're going to need to fill in something about what this place looks like. Here is, you know, the body language. Here's who moves where, but really, really bare bones. And so doing that, I do a lot of experiments. I write a lot of things that don't end up in the book. I just start making the characters talk to each other, you know, and that's where a lot of it grows out of. Those are the things that not only teach me who these people are, what these dynamics are, what these relationships are like, but also where the gaps are in the world building. If they're having a conversation and I run into a wall where it's like, well, I don't know, are there boats in this world? I don't know. I'm going to have to sit and figure it out. Do people eat? What do people eat? You know, if somebody refers to having lunch or whatever. That's often like some of the earliest work I do is just putting two characters in a room and making them talk. And then the rest of it gets fleshed out as I go along.
Yeah, that's great. Well, it definitely sounds like your theater background is helping. I've never, you know, we've talked to a fair number of authors and yeah, that's, I'm sure there's other people who do it that way, but I haven't met them yet. It's very cool. Okay, one more follow-up question on that. What about the names? You have such good names for your characters. How do you come up with those?
So this question makes me laugh because I hate naming things like more than anything. Really? I do. I find it really difficult, and so I'm very glad to hear that they're good.
They're fun. We love them.
Oh, good. It depends on the character. If it's a character who's going to be a point of view character, or you know, a very upfront character in some way, I need to name them early on because otherwise. You know, it's just impossible to write. And so with that, you know, if I'm writing a human, if I'm writing somebody where I can use actual existing names, I have a giant book of baby names I will go through and flip and like, you know, I'll write down a bunch of ones that seem right. And then there's just one that jumps out at me where I'm like, yep, yeah, that's it. That's the one. On occasion, this is a terrible thing to admit. On occasion, for like really minor characters, like really background characters, if it's somebody with just like a line or two, I might go to my friends and jump in the group chat, and I'm like, "Hey, I need a name. What's a name?" And so that's cheating, but I do it. With names that I have to make up, those are the worst. That's where I just sit and throw syllables together until it's something. Approximate, but I do also have a very bad habit with some characters where if I can get away without naming them, and this is true of locations too, the longer I can get away without naming them, and I'll just put in brackets like name or, you know, what sort of what their role is, pilot or whatever, I will do that until I reach a point where I'm infuriated with myself and I'm like, you just need to name this person, they've been around so
long.
No,
that makes perfect sense though, because like that's how you figure out who they are. Until they hang around for a while, how do you know what they're like?
Exactly.
So I like that. Well, cool. Well, they definitely work. The struggle is paying off. Yeah, they're good.
Totally. I think it's tough to hit that fine line between an alien name sounding alien and also being something that people can read and relate, identify with. And I think you nail it. And expanding on that, beyond characters to a more global scale, you know, you finished Wayfarers a few years ago, and now you're on book two, or you've released book two of Monk and Robot. What was it like switching between worlds? Like after you've done a volume of work and then you switch to a new one?
It's difficult. It was challenging in two different ways. In purely practically, mechanically speaking, I'd been writing Wayfarer for so long that it was so second nature at that point. Mm. By the time I wrote the fourth book, The Galaxy and the Ground Within, I didn't really need to look stuff up. You know, I have a private wiki where I keep all of my lore notes for Wayfarer so that I could, that's awesome. You know, go and refer to things. It's got, you know, a ton of lore that like didn't make it into the books, but I still draw from, but also, you know, reference points. Like if I need to go back into one of the previous books and look something up, you know, where here's where we established, I don't know, how Aelong color language works. Here's how we established gender among, you know, Andrisks, whatever it is, I can go back and find the page really quickly. By the fourth book, I didn't really need to check too much because it was just like, oh yeah, I live here. I know how things work, you know? But with Monk and Robot, it was a challenging switch because I was starting from scratch, you know, and it was all of a sudden like, oh, I don't know how anything works here. I don't know what basic everyday technology is. I don't know what they eat, what they're using for power sources. I don't know what local customs are. You know, all of the stuff that goes into world building. It was like, in this strange way, almost kind of culture shock of, oh, I'm somewhere new now. You know, I've just stepped off a plane into somewhere new and I've never been here before. This is a little intimidating. And then on the personal side of things, I was really nervous about it because it was, because Wayfarers has been so well received, and that is what I'd done to that point. You know, I had had one standalone novella in there, but otherwise that was pretty much what I had written. And I was worried about, are people going to want to come along with me on this? This is so different. This is such a different sort of setting, an extremely different world. am I going to be able to pull this off, or am I just a one trick pony? You know, that was an early fear that I had in stepping into those new waters.
And then you immediately won the Hugo for Best Novella. So yeah,
that is true. So
we were there. We heard your speech.
You're good.
Recorded.
Oh, good.
Yeah. The next question that's kind of related is, it when you're writing something, because Monk and Robot novella versus novel, do you set out saying, you know, I want to do something that's more of a like novella pace, and I think that's right for this story? Do you just kind of go for it, and you're like, and this is a novella? Or how does that, what's the novel versus novella like for you?
It's one of the few things that I actually do plan out in advance. Largely speaking, I'm very much a fly by the seat of my pants kind of writer. I don't outline and I don't write linearly. So like, I'm just figuring it out as I go, but length is actually really important because it's difficult to explain this part of the process, but obviously it's an incredibly different pace between a novel and a novella. And so I have to write in a much more economical, is kind of a cold word, but it's the best way I can think of it, with the novella. Like, you really have to get to the heart of something quickly, and you have to really think about, how to distill all those ideas in a way where you're getting the right things across, what's going to pack the biggest punch in this very, very short amount of time. And for me, novellas are actually more challenging because I'm wordy. I like to spread out. Like, short stories are beyond me. I've written a few short stories, but but I find them really difficult. I have so much respect for people who can do short stories, because it's, by the time I do like 2,000 words, I'm like, and now we are just getting warmed up, you know? So, it's really important for me to know at the outset of a project what sort of word count I'm going to be working with, because it hugely affects what I choose to include and how much rope I give myself in terms of like really digging into the world building, like really like sitting there and lingering with things like, let's just sit and talk about history for a while. Like, I think, you know, you want to have those sorts of things in a novella as well, but you do have to be more particular about what it is that you're choosing to include.
And so why did you choose to make Monk and Robot? Why did you go for novellas this time, knowing that you think about it ahead of time now?
Yeah, I just felt that there wasn't enough there to spread into a full novel. I felt that it would, because it's so, it's such a gentle story, and it's so, I mean, all of my stuff by design, I want it to be very low key. I want it to be very, we're just going to sit in this place and hang out with these people for a while. And that is interesting enough. We're not going to have like planets blowing up. I love a planet blowing up elsewhere, but not in my stuff, you know, like we're just going to sit and appreciate this for a moment. I feel like there's lots of that in Wayfarers, but Monk and Robot leaned into that so hard that I was like, I think that this will work in a nice short condensed format. I think an entire novel of this is going to stretch it out into tedium. And I never wanted it to get to that point. I always wanted it to feel like a nice break, a good nap, you know, like a short hike kind of a feeling. I didn't want it to feel like a slog. I didn't want it to ever get to the point where you're looking at it and being like, so what's happening here exactly? Like, I'm 200 pages in, and what's happening? Even though I didn't know the story in full, just everything I was feeling about it, everything I was envisioning for these characters, it just seemed like a shorter format was the more natural fit.
Yeah, I think that totally makes sense. I think it works as well. And it kind of naturally leads into our next question, which is going to be about conflict. Like, obviously, narratives need conflict. Storytelling needs conflict. You need to have something to rise to and resolve to make an interesting story. And you have a very singular use of identity and identity expression and identity finding as conflict in your novels, which is incredibly interesting. I think it's rare that, you know, usually conflict, like you said, is blowing up planets or chasing down bad people or stealing the heist case, whatever it is. Since yours centers around this identity search, and it's interesting because in real life, that's what our personal conflicts most commonly are, but no one writes about that. Why did you decide to write about that? Why don't you think people write about that more?
I think, those are two very different questions. So the reason,
okay. All right. remind on a prompt.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you. It started out with the long way, but I had this idea then that has really come along with me, even though all of my work since has, you know, I'm always tackling a different question with each book. So it's not that I'm perpetually chasing this, but in some ways, perhaps I am. I wrote The Long Way out of a place of, you know, huge, enormous love for the space opera that I grew up with. Star Wars, Star Trek, Farscape, you know, big hijinks in space, right? Like, we're going to go have a cool, crazy adventure in space. Loved that stuff. Whenever I would try to imagine myself in those settings, though, I never saw myself as one of the heroes. That I didn't, I admired those characters, I loved those characters, but I didn't see myself in them. And I was always drawn to the extras in the background. You know, when you have like a big multi-species spaceport that's full of puppets and weird people wearing weird masks. And I wanted to know more about them, you know, just what's it like just to live an incredibly ordinary life in a galaxy like this? What is it like to be the person who runs like the sandwich stall that the heroes stop at, you know, like what's it like to be that person? And so with The Long Way, that was very much, the intention was that just to flip the camera around to say, here are the sort of people who would just be walking through the background, who aren't movers and shakers. They're not anybody history is ever going to remember. They're just people living their lives and thinking about their jobs and their families and their own internal conflicts, their interpersonal conflicts. Like, they're just normal. They just happen to live on a spaceship, you know? And so what does that look like? And that was what I was attempting with The Long Way, and largely what I was still chasing with all of Wayfarers as well, of, you know, I am just going to paint a picture of everyday life within this extraordinary future. And I, in doing so, really developed this love for finding the exciting things within the mundane, you know. And it really made me think more about the, you know, most of us out here in the real world don't know any like villains, like any like, you know, big mustache twirling villains. That's rare. What we know are other people who are just worried about very small, you know, sort of localized things. We see this big stuff on the news, but that's not really what we're caught up in. That's the stuff we dismiss because we're worried about, you know, our kids or our friends or, you know, whatever existential crisis we may be in the middle of. And, that is interesting. That is just as interesting, I feel, as the big stuff. And so the farther I go along, the more and more I just sort of get this glee out of playing with the most simple, like finding the really big stuff in the most simple things, you know, because if you look at the sorts of things we do get caught up in here in the real world, they're often not the big stuff, you know, but it's still compelling. And it's still important, too, is the thing. I think there is a danger in saying the only stories worth telling are about heroes. The only stories worth telling are about the people you're going to build a statue of. We're all important and we're all unique. And so I think elevating stories of the everyday, of the forgettable, I think that it goes a long way to fostering a sense of belonging within the world. It's not that you don't matter. Most of us just matter in a small way, but that's still worth celebrating and it's still beautiful. And so those are the kinds of stories I write. And maybe one day I will get tired of doing that, but not anytime soon.
Yeah, well, you've proved that you can switch if you'd like. So whenever you feel. Why do you think others don't write about that as much? Why do you think it's not as common? Just because of the excitement level, the dopamine?
I think there's a lot of there are a lot of very deeply entrenched ideas about how a science fiction or fantasy novel has to be. Like, what a science fiction and fantasy story, like, the correct way to go about it, right? I struggled with this when I first started writing The Long Way. It was actually one of the things that hamstrung me from starting on it for a really long time, was I was like, this isn't a real science fiction book. Like, this isn't a real book because I don't have big stakes. I don't have a planet blowing up. This isn't a real book. And I see the same thing now at this point in my career, where I am often interfacing either with, aspiring writers like that I meet at bookstores and stuff, or, you know, debut people, whatnot. This is a thing I hear over and over and over again, regardless of whether it's about a theme or about a way of writing a book. As important as it is to understand the mechanics of here's how fiction works, here are the tools you need to use in order to reach your audience, etc., I think there is a danger of getting so stuck in that you're like, this is the only way to write a book. We have to have a 3-act or a 5-act structure. You have to have, you have to constantly be upping the stakes. You've got to have your climax and your denouement and whatever. You don't is the thing. And I will die on that hill. Like, you don't. What you have to do is just tell a good story. And that can look like anything. To me, the important thing is not, have I hit all the markers of a good story? The only thing that matters to me is the reader interested? And as long as the reader is interested, I can write about nothing for 100 pages and then we're fine. You know, I think that, as in so many things in life, we just get married to these concepts of these are the criteria in order for something to belong to this genre. You know, these are the criteria in order for the story to be taken seriously, for the story to work. And I think that that's not the only reason, but I think it's a large part of why, at least, this is difficult to say because there have always been people like pushing boundaries and experimenting in this genre. It is a genre of experimentation. That's what it is there for. But I think we are entering a point right now where people are getting more and more confident to break the rules even further, to get a little more radical with it, and to really push and say, okay, does it have to be this? What you know, can we blur the lines between the subgenres a bit? Can we have a story that has spaceships and magic? Why not? You know, we're starting to do more and more of that, and I find that really, really exciting. Right. Because I like to break the rules.
Totally. And at the end of the day, creative work, right? The only real rule is like, is it good?
Yeah, that's it.
Are people enjoying it? Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, it's easier said than done, of course. But we're glad you're breaking the rules. The conventions, at least.
Indeed.
But speaking of your influences and past, I guess, that wasn't a great segue. We're not speaking of that, but now I'm going to ask you about that. who are some of your favorite, most influential authors or stories? You could say a top five. You could just name a list, whatever you'd like.
For sure. The most influential by far was Ursula K. Le Guin. I started reading her when I was in high school. And up until that point, most of the science fiction I consumed was on TV or movies at that point. I wasn't a big sci-fi reader until then. As a girl, fantasy was a lot more easy to access. I felt a lot more welcome in fantasy than I did in sci-fi. And we could talk probably for an hour about that. And other
that
people
makes sense.
Have.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had an English teacher in high school who handed me The Left Hand of Darkness and was like, I think you'll really like this. And that was the book that took me from just enjoying this stuff as a fan to being like, I want to do this. I want to make this, because it was this just watershed moment for me of, oh my God, look what you can do. Like, look at what she's doing. She doesn't have planets blowing up in her stuff either. You know, hers is
right.
is so, let's just really dig into a culture and really feel something alien. And I mean, I devoured her stuff when I was younger. So she was huge for me. Again, you know, outside of the literature world, you know, once again, Star Trek was huge for me. I think that, not just as a writer, but as a person, it shaped my whole worldview. And so I feel like I'm constantly in conversation with that. And I also, this may sound tangential, but I promise it's relevant. I play,
that's okay.
I play a ton of video games, and I think that games have really strongly influenced, the way that I write and the way that I think about fiction as well. If you look at things in my work, like I'm very fond of, putting in, you know, here's what somebody is reading right now. Like, you know, somebody who's reading an article of some, or a book of some sort. That is 100% a trick I learned from video games, where people are in the habit of, you know, leaving single pages of their diaries lying all over the world. so like normal people do, you know. So yeah, again, once again, it's, I draw inspiration from all over the place. Like I think I, you know, every type of story, every book I've read, and every medium, really, even though there are things you can do in books that you can't do elsewhere, and it's true for everything, it all bleeds into my work in one way or another.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, what are you working on next? What can fans look forward to?
I can say very little at the moment, but I'm working on a new novel right now. It's in a new setting.
Monk and Robot?
It is not Monk and Robot. I'm not doing Monk and Robot right now.
Okay.
I'm doing something standalone. Cool. I needed to go elsewhere for a while.
Yeah.
But I will say, exactly as I said earlier, it's once again that feeling of just like, oh God, I don't know where I am. Like, you know, I don't know. You know, you've gotten off a plane and you're not sure what airport you're at. I'm starting to get out of that phase. I feel like now I've like unpacked my bag. I've found my way around the neighborhood. Like I'm starting to settle in. I still haven't figured out the grocery store, et cetera. This metaphor is getting strained, but you know what I mean?
No, it's excellent.
But yeah, I'm working on a new novel right now, and I really can't say anything other than it's got spaceships in it. So that's
okay.
Yes, I'm going, with Monk and Robot, I needed to just be somewhere terrestrial for a while. I'm like, I'm good with space for right now. Like I've been doing that a long time. I need to just go sit in the forest for a while. And now I've swung back around. Now the pendulum is back on the other side and I'm like, I want to go to space. So I'm going to space.
Get awesome. Back out there.
Yeah. Well, we're really looking forward to it. And it's been so wonderful talking with you. Thanks for spending the time with us today. It's been great.
Yeah. Likewise. This has been great. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Thank you, Becky.